This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
In Bangladesh, Hindus remain under siege, caught in a storm of arson, fear and intimidation amid political turmoil. Join me, Sahar Zand, as I uncover their fight for survival and justice in a nation on the brink.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste. I'm Devina Gupta. And on this edition, we are following two important cases in the US courts. First about the president-elect Donald Trump and the second about the popular app TikTok and its future. We'll get you latest in a moment. We're also going to Latin America, where amidst a political chaos, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is officially swearing in for a third term. We'll dive into what this means for the country's troubled economy. And finally, would you work a 90-hour week? One of India's top bosses thinks it's a good idea.
What do you do sitting at home? How long can you stare at your wife? How long can the wife stare at your husband? Come on, get to the office and start working.
There's a food for thought over there. But let's start with some breaking news from New York. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has been sentenced to an unconditional discharge on all counts in the so-called hush money case. He was convicted last May on 34 counts related to hush money paid to the adult film star Stormy Daniels. Mr. Trump joined the hearing via video link and told the court that this has been a very terrible experience. We'll be hearing live from our reporters very shortly on that story, so stay with us. But also, on the other side, it's also a crucial day for the popular social media platform TikTok, which is fighting a possible ban in the US market. And as we speak, the hearing has begun in the US court, where the company officials are appearing to challenge a law passed last year ordering the firm to be split from its Chinese owner, ByteDance, or be locked out from the US by 19th of January. It's a high-stakes showdown, and that could be a major precedent also for tech and privacy laws. So let's first go across to Lily Jamali, who is joining us. She's a tech correspondent. She's at the court. Lily, take it to the wire. What's happening there right now?
Well, right now, the 9 Supreme Court justices are probing the attorney for TikTok. They are asking him all kinds of questions. And the area that I'm most interested in, they're trying to probe just how close is TikTok to its owner, its Chinese owner, ByteDance, in order to ascertain whether there really is this specter, this possibility that TikTok is taking its cues from ByteDance and thereby from China.
But just remind us, why did TikTok go to the Supreme Court?
TikTok is appealing a decision that was handed up from the U.S. Appeals Court in Washington back in December, saying that a law that Congress passed this past spring is constitutional. That law gave TikTok 2 avenues. One, to either sell itself, really ByteDance, to have ByteDance sell TikTok to a U.S. owner, or to face a ban, which is set to kick in on January 19th. They have dug in and said they are absolutely not selling the platform. So effectively, the only avenue left is a ban. And they're saying that that robs the 170 million Americans on the platform of their free speech rights enshrined in the First Amendment of the Constitution.
And how does President-elect Donald Trump play into TikTok's future? Because he had proposed a ban in 2020, didn't he? And now has 15 million followers on that platform?
That's right. He tried to enact a ban by executive order. The Supreme Court struck that down, saying he didn't have the authority to do that. Now he has changed his tune. He says he wants to save TikTok. Part of that has to do with the election. He believes that it helped deliver him a large chunk of the youth vote. And he also has in a contributor someone named Jeffrey Yes, who is, I believe, an investor in ByteDance. So there's a whole host of reasons that he's interested. And he has asked the Supreme Court to delay, to allow just a little bit more time, because he comes in the day after, he takes office the day after this ban would take effect. He says he could come up with a political solution to this if he just could have that extra time to do so.
And this is a significant case for the company because we're talking about 170 million users who are now with TikTok.
Yes, and there are a whole host of content creators and also TikTok users who have been here at the Supreme Court this morning. I talked to pretty much everyone in line was about 20 or 21 years old. A lot of college students who are spending time here in Washington to either take classes or do internships in the government. And it was just fascinating hearing their various takes. Some people saying, well, multiple saying they get their news from TikTok. And if they don't go on TikTok, it's because they used it for a while and realized how much time they were spending on it. And they do, I think, subscribe to this concern that there is something somewhat addictive about the platform. I was interested in this one student who said she understands the concern about, you know, there's this possibility of Chinese manipulation. Maybe there's, you know, that possibility exists, but she doesn't really care because it's worth the kind of information that she's able to glean from the platform. I found that very interesting. And it's a sentiment shared by many.
Thanks, Lily, for that. Keep an eye on those hearings. We'll come back to you later. That's BBC's Lily Jamali there. But let's go now to the breaking news that we talked about at the start of the show, where U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has been sentenced in a New York courtroom. We have now our correspondent, Michelle Fleury, who's joining us. Michelle, tell us what exactly happened. And President-elect Donald Trump wasn't really personally in court.
No, now, I mean, what was interesting about this is that he didn't have to turn up in person. So he appeared virtually from Florida. Judge Juan Merchan, the New York judge who oversaw the initial Trump trial, had ordered the sentencing case, but had signaled that Trump didn't have to appear in person. He also indicated that he wouldn't face penalties or prison time. And that is exactly essentially what we saw happen today. And all of this, of course, playing out against that kind of backdrop of the last minute appeal, you may recall, by Donald Trump, his emergency request. He tried to get the proceedings delayed, appealing to the Supreme Court. But ultimately, they decided that it could proceed. And so that's why we find ourselves here today with Donald Trump essentially facing this sort of sentencing. And so becoming, about to be inaugurated as a convicted felon.
But let's not forget, there is no jail or fine imposed on him. Just remind us of that case, first of all. And what does this mean for the American public? How are they viewing it?
Yeah, I mean, so this all, as you say, arises from his conviction in May of falsifying business records. This related to payments to his then lawyer, Michael Cohen, to reimburse hush money payments made to an adult film star, Stormy Daniels. This was to try and prevent her from speaking out about an alleged affair they had before the 2016 election. That's sort of what the root of all of this was. A jury found Trump guilty, and then there was the sentencing. But what changed the dynamics of the outcome of all of this was Donald Trump winning re-election and also a Supreme Court ruling about sort of the powers of the presidency. And so because of that, Judge Marchand rejected the argument that the case should be thrown out entirely, but did go with this sort of extraordinary sentencing in which you see him essentially kind of being convicted and now sort of having the title of convicted felon, but without having to serve any time or kind of face any sort of real penalties.
And let's step back a bit for our global audiences as well. What does this mean for the world's largest economy. You have a president-elect who will be sworn into the White House later this month with that tag.
Well, I mean, I think, look, it's one of perception, right? I mean, it is embarrassing. He becomes the first president who is a convicted felon. But that being said, the American public had all the facts at their disposal when they went to the polls. And, you know, a huge majority of people decided that ultimately it didn't matter to them, that they were more concerned about things like their daily cost of living. And they felt that Trump, as a businessman, had a better solution to that problem. And the economy kind of played a huge part in their decision to re-elect him to a second term.
BBC's Michelle Flory, thank you so much for joining us with all those updates. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Service. Now, the much-awaited jobs report is also out from the US, and the growth is much stronger than expected. Shanti Killerman is the Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. Hi, Shanti. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Well, crunch those numbers for us, first of all, Shanti. So much going on in the courts. Let's step out now and talk about the US job report, the real numbers.
Yeah, so it was much better than expected. We had the U.S. added 256,000 jobs in the month of December. That was more than the 212,000 in November. And the unemployment rate also edged down a bit to 4.1%. So all in all, really positive, but it sent the yields on government bonds a bit higher. People thinking it's less likely we'll have interest rates come down because the economy is okay and probably doesn't necessarily need it.
So essentially, if somebody's looking for a job in that market, it's a good news. But if somebody's looking to buy a new home or a new car with the wages they earn, might not be such a good news because the U.S. Central Bank could retain the high rates right now. But also tell us about on the other side of the Atlantic. We've been keeping a close watch on the pound and borrowing costs of the U.K. government. What's the health analysis for the pound today?
The pound was down slightly today, but not a huge move. The interest rates on bonds were up a little bit. But I think that's not really related to the UK. It's more that the UK will follow where the US moves. The US acts as kind of an anchor for global bond prices. And if people are going to, you know, invest in a different country's debt, they'll look at that as a reference. So obviously, as you know, people take out lending or mortgages, it will be a bit of higher cost. On the flip side, though, there's millions of savers who have investors who benefit a bit when rates go up. You know, it's had the effect of making pension liabilities much more in a much healthier place as we've had interest rates come up in the past 2 years.
Well, we use this word a lot, bond, which is like an IOU, is what it can be explained as, that can be traded in the financial markets. And governments generally spend more than they raise in tax. So they borrow money to fill that gap by selling bonds to investors. And Shanti, the UK government's borrowing costs has also gone up tremendously. I was reading it's nearly highest in 16 years. So what does this mean for people there and the economy?
So that's for the, if the UK government wants to borrow money for 30 years, the interest rate they have to pay to investors is the highest it's been since, I think it's 1998 now. So basically, over time, as the government borrows more money and as bonds it's issued in the past expire, its borrowing costs will go up. That means the government either needs to bring in a bit more money or spend a bit less money. So they'll have to choose how to balance those things. If you can get the economy growing, you do get more money in, you know, as so that's the best solution, but it's probably the most challenging to get going.
Hmm. Shanti, be with us because I want to talk to you more on other stories as well. Now, let's go to political chaos elsewhere in the American continent. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro is presently being sworn in for the third term to lead his country. And despite a 6-month dispute over a July election and international calls for him to stand aside, many countries, including the U.S., reject the election result as fraudulent and recognize the now exiled opposition candidate, Edmundo Gonzalez, as the legitimate president-elect. So there have been widespread protests against his plan to serve a third 6-year term. And that's what you're hearing right now. In fact, just yesterday, one opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, was detained after leading protests against President Maduro's inauguration. But there's also been demonstrations across South America. In a moment, we'll also hear from Dr. Vanessa Norman. She was part of President Juan Guaido's government in 2019. He was recognized as Venezuela's president by many Western countries following an uprising against Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. president back then was Donald Trump. He welcomed Juan Guaido to Congress.
Maduro's grip on tyranny will be smashed and broken. Here this evening is a very brave man who carries with him the hopes, dreams, and aspirations of all Venezuelans. Joining us in the gallery is the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. Mr. President, please take this message back that all Americans are united with the Venezuelan people in their righteous struggle for freedom. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Well, that was 2019. Cut to 2025. Things are very different. Dr. Neumann, listening back to that, is the situation worse now or then?
I don't know. Well, it depends how you count it. I think Edmundo González has an unquestionable legitimacy. Juan Guaido sort of had the legitimacy of a constitutional, basically, loophole that when it's vacated, when the presidency is vacated because the election is not certified, then the president of the National Assembly is him. Edmundo González unquestionably won an election in a 2-1 landslide, which is why you're not seeing the regime show those numbers. And so in a way, it's easier to get international support now, because you had the Venezuelan people have spoken unquestionably. However, it is worse in that the Venezuelan people are more despondent and the international community is more exhausted, right? We've been in this situation pleading for international support, actually, not just since 2019, since 2017, when the mass protests emerged. And Venezuela was basically, you know, on fire with millions and millions of people protesting. And the Venezuelan people see that no matter what happens, even when they turn out to vote, at great risk to their lives, and a number of my friends, for instance, have been kidnapped and tortured in the last couple of weeks. You know, so it's very endemic and systemic.
And disappointing and frustrating. Absolutely. Exactly. I'm sorry to hear that. But, you know, over 7 million Venezuelans have left the country in the last decade. And listening to you, one can imagine why. But what's the reality for those who have stayed back in terms of job, in terms of daily life and hope?
Well, in terms of daily life and hope, there is none. And we're actually expecting now that Maduro has you know, sworn himself in, he doesn't care if people who don't like him leave. It suits him down to the ground. So we're expecting yet another wave. Another 1 in 4 Venezuelans has already left. It's more like 8 million. And 40% of those remaining have said that they will leave. So you have a mass migration problem all over the world, all over the Western Hemisphere, particularly into the United States, but also into Europe, because over the years, certain Venezuelans have settled into Europe, like Madrid, where I'm living at the moment, is a huge draw. And then they bring their relatives. So this is a global problem. It's a bigger exodus even than Syria or Sudan. So for the reality for everyone there, unless you're, you know, what's being left behind is our narco business, where you have Ferrari dealerships and, you know, dollar price restaurants in Las Mercedes. And then for the rest of the world who is not in on it. You know, they're earning bolivares, which are worth nothing, and have to spend in dollars. And it's just untenable.
Didn't Maduro in his first 2 terms implemented various economic measures, including price controls and currency manipulation? Do you think that there could be economic policy in third term that could turn around some new approaches that could help circumvent those sanctions also from the U.S. and other Western nations?
I don't know. I think, well, the circumventing of sanctions is already in the works, right, with people like Russia and Iran and trade with China and also India and through the UAE. So all of those places, perform the service of access of either barter trade in the case of Russia and access to dollars via India and UAE. Now, there really is no growth plan. What Maduro will try to do with Donald Trump is he will try to negotiate a deal whereby if he can hold back the mass migration problem I just talked about, then he'll try and take some payoff. Like, for instance, you know, lift the sanctions on American drilling and give some portion of that to the Maduro regime in exchange for preventing the migration. It puts Trump in a very difficult situation.
Yep.
Does he choose migration or does he choose toppling Maduro?
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Vanessa Neumann there. But it is the Trump's deal making that we've been talking about so far, and going back to the story of a flip flop that he's done about the social media platform TikTok. Now, we earlier heard that how in the U.S. court right now, oral arguments are being heard between TikTok representatives and the U.S. government representatives, whether to ban the company or not, or whether it can divest to another American player or not. In India, where I'm joining you from, TikTok has been banned. And that's why let's go across now to Pawan Duggal, who is cyber law expert, joining us here from India as well. Pawan, we've seen this script play out because of geopolitical tensions between India and China, where TikTok was banned in 2020. Is it easy to move out this social media platform in a market like the US as well?
I don't think it's going to be easy for TikTok to be virtually thrown out of the American market. This is so because they have a big chunk of the user database. But then please realize that the administration already has put in place a law which is asking TikTok company to either disinvest or alternatively face closure. Now, even if it's going to be closure or otherwise, TikTok, I believe, would have taken sufficient steps on a backup basis so as to move its servers outside the territorial boundaries of the US and still make it available globally, and thereby opening up the doors for Americans to use virtual private networks to access the said TikTok. But it will be very interesting, because ultimately at the heart is the issue as to where does the court want to ultimately lean into. Is it freedom of speech and expression? Is it national security? There have been so many questions asked and raised about TikTok. And that's what we'll have to look at.
Is the collateral damage also with the employees and also the brand? Because when it happened in India, it was almost overnight that people who were employed with TikTok had to figure out what next to do.
I think those are collateral damages that TikTok will have to take into consideration. And also, in case if it's asked to be disinvesting or completely closure of business, it is a big setback for this company. But I'm sure with a huge kind of a global presence, and given the fact that they have made statements that disinvestment is a complete no-no, I think they would be mentally prepared to have a closure and then to operate from other jurisdictions.
And briefly, Pawan, because does it also benefit other social media platforms? Like in India, we have Meta, which has benefited because of Instagram, and people are now using Reels there, or Google, which has seen growth of YouTube.
Well, clearly, the exit of TikTok from the American market is going to have a directly beneficial impact upon all the American service providers, whether it's the Googles, the Facebooks, or the Twitters, or the Instagrams of the world. The reason is very simple. Their market share is then going to be diverted on to these new kind of available service providers. So I think it's an economic issue, it's a social issue, it's a legal issue, and most importantly, it's a strategic issue. So it'll be interesting to see how the U.S. Court ultimately weighs up in which direction.
And I'm sorry to give you 30 seconds for this, but what kind of precedent is it setting for other geographies for TikTok?
Well, I think the precedent is loud and clear. The countries are saying my national security is far more important than any other application provider. So you better well comply with my laws. Otherwise, be prepared to pack up your bags and leave my jurisdiction, because my national security is far more paramount.
Pawan Duggal, cyber law expert in India. And TikTok, interestingly, is also blogged in Iran, Nepal, Afghanistan and Somalia. And let's stay in India, because it's Friday. And well, as many of us are looking forward to a weekend rest away from the office, the boss of one of the largest companies here has said that he'd have his employees working on Sunday if he had his way. In fact, the chairman of L&T, N. Subramanian, has called for a 90-hour work week.
I regret I'm not able to work, make you work on Sundays, to be honest. If I can make you work on Sundays, I'll be more happier, because I work on Sundays also. What do you do sitting at home? How long can you stare at your wife? How long can the wife stare at your husband? Come on, get to the office and start working.
It gets me every time I hear that statement. Ouch! Earlier, I gauged a reaction from a group of young people on the streets here in Delhi about this.
No amount of money, I think, can convince me to work 90 hours a day. That's basically dehumanizing. So it does reek of colonialism in some senses.
But why is it that we're hearing more of such statements from senior leaders in India? Narayan Murthy also said that Indians should work 70 hours in a week.
These companies, and even the whole trademark or the marketing gimmick that they put up, is that we have to compete with China and whatnot. If I'm spending 90 hours a week at my office, I'm sacrificing on my personal life. I'm sacrificing on my mental and emotional health.
The older generation, they were very much comfortable with the number of hours they were working, and the responsibilities were very neatly defined. The fathers used to work and the mothers used to like take care of the house and everything. Now, these days, everybody is a lot more aware.
All of you come from a fairly comfortable background. That's because your parents actually worked more.
I mean, I'm sure we all are hustling. We all are chasing this one perfect little life that we've been spoon-fed at this point of time.
Taking a work call is also okay over the weekend?
If the weekends are for me, then they're for me. I'll get back to it as soon as possible on Monday.
So managers need to learn then how to deal with a new age workforce in India.
Yeah, of course. I don't think I would mind working for 90 hours, and I would not mind asking my employees to work 90 hours, because that is going to make me money.
Really?
Huh. So this if is that's filling my pockets, share the
you're a tough
very
boss.
Yes.
You're a tough boss then.
I'm
All right, well, I'll leave you to decide what you would like to do with that 90-hour work week or not. But after a nationwide backlash, L&T has made an official statement saying nation building is at the core of the mandate, and that the chairman's remark reflects that larger ambition. Shanti, do you agree?
I don't agree with the 90-hour work week. I don't think I could do it. But there will be people out there that are really driven and maybe want to. But I think as, you know, as more women have come into the workforce, you have more people where both parents are working. It's just not possible. We'd need much better government childcare support systems for that to
Absolutely.
Work.
Absolutely. Shanti Kellerman, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. Thank you for joining us.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.